What's new, Pussycat, on this Playback Daily? Welsh snake hips charmer Tom Jones. A simple tale about life's big questions and a David and Goliath fight for the truth. It's Friday the 23rd of April. I'm Gemma Craddock and this is what's coming up.
The shower head was close to the door and I opened my eyes, got the shampoo out of my hair, and there was Elvis's face. He was leaning over the door singing this bloody song to me.
I always feel like, you know, life's too short just to lie, and life's hard enough without trying to be someone else.
Our lives have been completely turned upside down. All the dreams that we had as a family have, you know, turned into an absolute nightmare.
The deceptively simple story of the boy, the mole, the fox and the horse has captivated readers. And with sales of the book having reached 100,000 copies here in Ireland, author Charlie Mackesy chatted to self-confessed fan Ray Darcy.
It's a graphic novel, but novel's a bit of an impressive word for it. I mean, I wouldn't call it a novel. It's really, so it's a lot of drawings and some words.
Yeah, well, you're underselling it now, Charlie, in a big way. it's the most beautiful self-help book that I've ever, witnessed, and I've read an awful lot of them. I've read an awful lot of them for work, not for me, but for work.
Come on.
Yeah. So will you explain to our listeners then the genesis of the whole thing?
Well, it's hard really to explain it because I'm not really completely sure how it happened, but it began in a barn where I work, and just, you know, I've been an artist for a long time, but I started just doing these drawings of a boy and a fox and a boy and a mole. There's these three characters this boy talks to, and he asks them important questions, or questions that I've always had. And then I just started these conversations and then would put them on Instagram. And I had a bit of an intense conversation with a friend about what courage was, and he's really brave. And I've never been that brave about, you know, climbing mountains. But I think one of the bravest things you could ever do is actually really just say help when things were difficult.
Yeah.
As a man. And so I did the drawing, and I drew the boy saying to the horse, "What's the bravest thing you've ever said?" And the horse said, "Help." And I put that on Instagram, and then, you know, I just kind of forgot about it, and then was really shocked a few hours later to see the reaction. And then I got emails from people, the army, for instance, and various people in PTSD clinics in Australia and whatever, saying, "Can we use the drawing?" I'd be like, "Of course you can. You know, that's what they're for." But I never thought really that it would ever be a book. I just thought I would do these little drawings that might make people feel a bit better, you know, or give them courage, or, you know, it was not really, I never really dreamt I'd be on Irish radio talking to someone about it. You know, it is so far from where I was. Yeah. I'm just a scruffy bloke with a dog in a barn. You
know? Yeah, again, underselling yourself, Charlie.
No, it's true. No, it's actually true.
I suppose not to get too deep too fast, but your vulnerability as a human being shines through the whole book.
Okay.
Yeah, and your fragility, you know, and it's a beautiful fragility. And
thank you.
But I don't think if you weren't that you could have made this thing. Do you know what I mean?
I think being human isn't that easy. And I think we're all pretty fragile and underneath it, quite vulnerable and all those things. And I think being able to chat about them, be honest about them, is a way that can actually connect us, really.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, really what we want anyway. So I just sort of started drawing all that stuff out and seeing how people felt about it. But that's lovely you said that. Thank you. I mean,
and then
so
it started on social media, as a lot of things do these days. And then you said, "Well, sure, I'll do an exhibition."
Exactly. Yeah, I just said it on, because I've been with galleries and stuff, and I just thought, well, you know, I'll just do it on my own and just rent a big room, a big gallery room that I rented, and just put it on Instagram saying, "By the way, if you're interested," you may well not be, but I'm going to just hang some of these drawings up and see what happens. And it was quite shocking, really, the number of people that sort of turned up. It was thousands of them, and it was overwhelming, and I really wasn't expecting it. And a friend was helping me, and we sometimes couldn't get in the door, and you know, had these chats with people till late in the night because they stayed on. And you know, a lot of them were grown men who were in tears about their journeys in life and how just these little drawings had been part of their, you know.
Yeah.
you know what? It was really shocking, right? And then, you know, at that exhibition, there just happened to be a publisher who she'd come along because she'd been following me and said, "Do you want to do a book?" And I said, "I don't. Do you think I could? I'm not sure if it would make a book, would it? You know, all these things." And so that's how it started, anyway.
Yeah. There's an Irish connection in that, like, back a few generations, your people were from Wicklow, was it?
Yeah, Wicklow and Waterford, yeah, the Maxis, yeah, my dad's side.
And there's a more direct current connection with the book in that the man who put it together, literally put it together, is who?
Colm Roach, he lives in Cork, actually. And, you know, the lovely thing about this book is, you know, because being an artist, you spend a lot of your life alone, and it's brought me in from the cold, and I work with Colm, and we've become really close, really good friends because of it. Because we just journey. He would come around to the house, and you know, just sit there, and I'd say, "What about this drawing?" Because to be honest with you, the book is like, it's not that there aren't that. I don't know how many drawings there are in it, but there's maybe 10,000-12,000 drawings
right
in the studio. So we had to sift through them and eliminate the ones that weren't right, and then some of them had coffee stains on them, so we had to clean them up. And you know, he's a legend because he would help me do that. And
there is a coffee cup stain on one of them still.
There is one, yes.
And there is.
I left that one.
Yeah, my dog walked on over the drawing, clearly trying to make the point. The point being, the greatest illusion, said the mole, is that life should be perfect.
Yes, it is. It's an illusion. Yeah.
So let's go through some of the things because they're so, I don't know, they cut to the core of things. Like we had a long chat up in the office a few weeks ago before we even knew we were doing some other book. I think it was about the science of happiness.
Okay.
And the whole topic of comparing ourselves to others came up.
Exhausting, isn't it?
Yes. Here's a little exchange between the boy and the mole. What do you think is the biggest waste of time? Comparing yourself to others, said the mole. But we're hardwired for it, Charlie. Are we?
I think we are. We are. And we're also very hard on ourselves when it comes to that, you know.
Yeah.
And I've done it all. I think I wrote that because, you know, it's one of the things I've struggled with because, you know, friends of mine just, you know, I think I'd look at me. I'm just, you know.
Go on.
No grubby fingernails scuffling around in the bushes, basically, you know, just this slightly rural bloke, not really getting it together, and everyone's sort of streaming on ahead. And I think, oh man, you know, how am I going to ever achieve what they have? And it would get me down. And then one day I just thought, well, what's the point of this? Why not just forget what everybody, you know, celebrate them, but don't compare yourself and just accept yourself exactly where you are in your skin at this moment. And it's good and you're okay. And love yourself right there, and see success not as material things, but as relational things. So if you have friends, then that's the greatest success you could ever have. And, you know, kids or a wife, whatever it is, those are the things. And don't compare yourself, even on that level, actually. That's, again, a waste of time. So, anyway.
The next page, I wonder if there's a school of unlearning.
Yeah, right.
Because it's not that thing, you know, we learn hate, you know. We're not born with hate, for example.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. And we learn prejudices.
Yeah, we do. We learn them. We listen and we learn and we develop these strange ideas over time, don't we? And to unlearn them is a good thing. And we sort of learn things about ourselves through things that sometimes are said to us that we need to unlearn.
Yeah.
And there's so much, to unlearn, I think.
Is that friend that you alluded to earlier in our conversation, the very brave friend, is that Bear Grylls?
Ah, the lovely Bear, yeah. Yes. I mean, I've known him for years and years and years and years.
I wouldn't have put the two of you together.
No, we're unlikely friends, but I think they're often the best.
Did you go to college together or what? No,
I just met him through friends, really. We just got chatting, and I think we both found each other quite. Well, I think he found me ridiculous, but we got on really well, and always have been good friends.
Okay.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, he's a sort of adventure explorer, and I'm, you know.
Well, and this is your impact on people and these drawings, and like tell us. I know you're. I'll have to actually make the questions because you're not going to offer up stuff. So you said about armies and PTSD, but during the lockdown, the book came into its own, didn't it? And your Instagram account came into its own, and people in the NHS working on the front line were putting up posters in nurses' stations, etc. All over the place. Yeah. How did that make you feel?
It's hard to describe, really, because it just makes me feel very moved, and I feel a sense of privilege and gratitude, and I get overwhelmed because you could just make marks and write a few words on pages, and they'd end up in an ICU unit, or you know, in a place where nurses have their cup of tea and they're struggling, or in wards where the COVID wards they had them stuck on the walls, or you know, and then I'll get letters from people who said that in the school that when it was shut down that one headmaster had blown them up sort of 4 foot square and stuck them on the windows facing out so the kids would see them, and you know, anything like that, I just found really moving. And actually I got a letter recently from a nurse who said that everybody in her ward had COVID and they're all off except her, and she was really, really struggling and said that she was considering not being alive anymore, but she just kept the messages of the book in with her next to her in her bag, and she just wrote to me to say, you know, well, she told me that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I just my eyes well up really, because if you can help someone, I mean, they're heroic, aren't they? So
yes.
If you can help someone in that situation, then I'll always.
Brilliant. Yeah.
You know, but it's not something, Ray, that I ever designed or would ever thought would ever happen. You know, it's like, but I'm not sure how it happened.
But you've been, there's an honesty. That's it. You know, and you see, when I read it first, I thought, oh, this guy has been swatting up on the self-help books. And then I read it again and I realized that this has come from a rawness. This has come from a living of a life, a certain type of life. Is that right, or am I just making that up?
No, well, to be honest with you, life is pretty raw. And I lost my best friend when I was 18.
Right.
And then I lost a series of friends in various ways. A couple of them took their lives or whatever. And, you know, so I think it's just been one of those lives where you have to face painful things a lot. And what do you do with that? And where do you go with that? And how do you communicate that? How do you open up about that? What's the healthiest way of getting through this? And what's the most hopeful thing you can do for yourself and other, you know, et cetera. And there's not really any time to pretend. I think I always feel like, you know, life's too short just to lie.
Yeah.
And life's hard enough without trying to be someone else.
Yeah.
So just tell the truth. And it's really courageous to tell the truth of who you are, whatever you feel. And I think sometimes we worry that will distance us from people, but actually it does the opposite. And I think, you know, the braver we are with how we feel and how we see the world and how we see ourselves, you know, the better it gets in terms of our connection with each other. But it took me a long time to really discover that, you know.
Do you mind me asking what age you are, Charlie?
Oh, gosh, yeah, I'm in my 50s.
Like, right, okay.
I'm old now.
No, that's not old, because I'm in my 50s.
I think I'm either 58 or 59. I think I'm 59.
He doesn't know what age he is.
I really know. And sometimes, you know, when you kind of ignore it. When you get to this level, you think, oh, it's just not important or interesting. I've lived a while. I don't know how I've managed to get this far.
We're all thankful that you have, because you produced this book. But the boy, the mole, the fox and the horse, and you say that they're all aspects of one person. You know, they're all represent various personality traits or strengths or weaknesses of us all.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I realised that afterwards, or certainly not. I didn't at the outset go, right, let's just summarise the different parts of me with a mole and a fox but they definitely are the bits of me and us, you know. So for instance, the fox is the hurt bit, the damaged bit, the part of us that struggles to trust and keeps a distance, and the mole is the insatiable one that leaps to cake when things are difficult, and the boy is the inquisitive one with the questions, and then there's the horse who's like the soul, you know, the depth, the gentle a bit of the deepest part of us, I think.
See, Fiona was on as well. He has such an infectious laugh. How old is he? And is he single?
I'm old and I'm single.
I love our listeners. A good while ago,
lovely things that when I discovered a year or so ago, you know, on Instagram, I discovered that like a large swathe of the followers on Instagram are in Dublin.
All right, and yes,
I loved that. I couldn't get as really. So thank you.
Yeah. What's the piece of music at the end on the inside cover at the back?
Yeah, well, that was an accident. Again, to be honest with you, I really love how it looks, music sheets look. Just I like drawing. I've always liked drawing on them, writing music, even though I'm not reading, you know, whatever. So that was a mistake, but it's by Schumann, and it's just that it's like a little march.
Uh-huh.
But funnily enough, it really works. When Colm and I listened to it, and friends have played it on the piano, and it's pretty sweet sound. Really.
Okay.
It goes da 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 da. Like that. It's already sort of simple little tune, you know.
But positive and forceful.
Very, very, very. Yeah, it's like a little...
Going forward. We're going forward.
It's a skipping. Yeah, exactly. Let's get through this together. Which is fortunate, really.
Now, finally, before we let you go, is this hindsight? But you had a sense that you had to get the book out, as if there was something on the way that might stop you getting it out.
I just remember saying to Colm in that year, you know, gosh, this is a struggle, isn't it? But we have to do this, and it's important that we're doing this. And he sort of felt that I could, when you have a sort of strange feeling that something's, you just have to get it done.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite know why. And, you know, we just really wanted to make something. I mean, sales of the book were not the thing for me, never were. It's just we wanted to make something that, you know, might help people.
Charlie McAsee on The Ray D'Arcy Show. On the 10th of March 2019, a Boeing 737 MAX crashed just minutes after the flight from Addis Ababa to Nairobi took off, killing all 157 people on board. One of the passengers that day was Clareman, husband and father of two, Mick Ryan. This morning, Mick's widow, Nisha, spoke with Claire Byrne about all the questions that remain unanswered, but began by talking about her husband and his work.
Mick was the global deputy chief engineer at the World Food Programme. WFP is the largest of all the UN agencies, and it provides food security to some of the most vulnerable people in the world. I suppose WFP it's not just about food, it's also about providing access to areas where people need it the most. And Mick... He was part of an engineering unit in there that provided this kind of infrastructure for WFP so that they could get access and provide humanitarian aid.
And he started his work with the UN first when he was only 24. I mean, clearly this humanitarian core was always there, was it? From when you met him, certainly, this was always what he was destined to do, was it?
I mean, from the moment I met him, Mick had just a lust for life, he was very passionate about people and very interested in different parts of the world and different cultures. And he very much wanted to travel and see the world. And I suppose part of that then was an awareness of what people were suffering in other parts of the world. You know, places that we only hear about really in books or in the media. He just had a deep kind of fascination and interest in these places.
And you're a civil engineer yourself, and that's you met through your work. Is that right?
Well, we actually met in college, and we were both doing civil engineering postgrads in college, we kind of started our journey from there.
And did you work overseas together?
We did. When Mick was based in Sri Lanka after the 2004 tsunami, I had been working at home on my own kind of projects and stuff, and developing my own experience and skills. And we just decided we'd been apart for too long. And I joined him in Sri Lanka. And I suppose being an engineer, it meant I had something to offer as well to the situation.
And then you both came back, but then the draw to work on these types of projects overseas again was too much for Mick, and he went back to that work.
Yeah, we came back really to get married and, you know, kind of have some sort of normal life in Ireland. But in 2012, Mick, you know, he just, you could say he had a calling or a draw towards it. He really missed the work. And we spoke about it, and there was a position opened in Ethiopia at the time. So he went to Ethiopia to head up the engineering unit there.
Mm-hmm. And you went on then to have two children.
That's right. Sarah and MacDara, yeah.
And then when this happened, when Mick died 2 years ago, your children were very young, just 6 months and three. Is that right?
That's right. Sarah was 3.5 and MacDara was just 6 months old.
OK, so it was March of 2019.
Yeah.
Will you talk to me a little bit about what happened from your perspective on that day?
Well, it's a day I'll never forget. It was a normal Sunday morning. I was on my own with the two kids. It was about 10 o'clock that morning, and I just checked my phone and realised I had a number of missed calls and a message from a friend of ours in Rome. And, you know, it just seemed a bit strange. The messages seemed a bit urgent, and he asked me to call him. So he had messaged me as well to say, had I seen the news? So I really thought nothing of it, and I called him back immediately. And that's when he told me that a plane had gone down in Addis and that Mick might have been on that plane.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading back on what happened to you, and Mick had texted you, hadn't he, as he was getting on the flight at 4 o'clock Irish time. And then you had sent him a picture of yourself and the children when you all woke up that morning. So I just can't imagine the shock then of getting those messages.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, it doesn't seem real. And in a way, it still doesn't seem real that day happened. I don't think our minds are designed to take that kind of information in. Mm-hmm. You know, it sent me into a state of I just kind of went numb and maybe into autopilot. I knew I had to ring my sister because my kids were at that point. I'd gone upstairs, so I just needed someone to come and look after my kids that were downstairs. And you're just plummeted into some sort of twilight zone. I suppose now I realize, looking back, you it's trauma, you know, you just go into a state of trauma. So it's
And the crash in which Mick died, it was the second fatal crash involving this Boeing 737. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So about five months prior to the Ethiopian airline crash, a Lion Air flight took off from Indonesia, and 189 people were killed minutes after the plane took off. In both cases, the crashes were associated with a software failure known as MCAS, which is an acronym for Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System. It's a Boeing acronym. And it was very similar circumstances.
Because what you've learned about the aircraft on which Mick was travelling, this was the Boeing 737 MAX as well. So despite the fact that this crash had happened, they continued to use this plane.
That's right. It seems inconceivable because at the what we found out afterwards from reports and testimonies that came out was when they looked into the first crash, the FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Authority in the US, had predicted a further 15 crashes would happen specifically due to the MCAS during the lifetime of these planes, which, you know, kind of accounts for 30-35 years. But the Boeing took a gamble and they decided to keep the planes flying. And in the meantime, kind of work on the problem of fixing the MCAS.
To be really clear and explain to people, this plane, this MAX, was essentially an old plane with adjustments.
So the design, the plane itself wasn't an old plane. The design of the plane goes back to the 1960s. So the original Boeing 737 is a 1960s design. And every time a new plane is designed, it can take years before it becomes certified and can fly. In this case, they didn't have years because they were in direct competition with Airbus. Airbus had just released their own plane. It was the Airbus A320neo. And, you know, their customers were starting to buy up those planes. It was a fuel efficient plane. So they needed to get this plane up and running in a matter of months. So they basically went for amended certification under the 737 Boeing plane. And that's how they came up with the MAX.
Okay, I'm trying to make this simple for all of us to understand. But if Boeing were using this plane, for example, for American Airlines, it had two sensors on it. But if they were selling it overseas to the rest of the world, they gave them an option as to whether they wanted two sensors or one sensor. And you believe that's critical?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems insane that something that was, you know, a matter of safety, you know, like absolute safety priority, that they would give an option for these sensors. They should have just been, you know, a minimum of two sensors installed as standard. But these sensors are like little weather vanes. They're, you know, they're quite delicate. But they are the things that they're called angle of attack sensors, and that's what sends the information to the MCAS. And if those sensors are faulty, it sends incorrect information to the MCAS, and MCAS kicks in and takes over the plane. So the pilots have no control.
And despite the fact then that in January, Boeing was fined $2.5 billion by the US Justice Department, the findings were pretty damning of the company. The Boeing MAX has returned to service now.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's kind of inconceivable. First of all, nobody has been held to account, not one single individual. The U.S. Conducted a 18-month congressional investigation, and from that report, it came out that the FAA was a technically flawed agency. That Boeing had a culture of concealment within their organization, that there was too much of an overlap between the FAA and the Boeing for it to be appropriate in terms of putting passenger safety first. And then in terms of the Deferred Prosecution Agreement, the DPA, which came up with the $2.5 billion fine.
Yes.
It's a joke, you know.
In the context of that company and the amount of cash that it has and it brings in on an annual basis.
And the breakdown even of the fine, the actual government fine is only 10%. The rest, 70%, go towards their airline customers. You know, it's just inconceivable. And also, the families were mentioned in this DPA, but we were never consulted.
And in basic terms, again, you want to know exactly what they knew or what they learned after the first crash.
Absolutely. We want to know what they knew, who knew what, and when.
I mean, this is a huge company. It's the biggest manufacturing company in America, and so many other companies linked to it providing parts for Boeing. But you're pursuing a civil case against Boeing in the United States.
That's right.
It's a mammoth task.
It I suppose it is. But, you know, myself and a number of other families in America and Canada and France, we're just in the pursuit of the truth and justice and ultimately accountability, because you can't have real change. You can't guarantee that passenger safety will come first, you know, unless you have real change, unless you have accountability, unless you have justice. And we want justice for our loved ones that were on that plane.
I'm just going to ask you why, you know, you're doing this. Clearly, this is something, you're a civil engineer, so you know what you're looking at when you're looking at all of the technical reports and so on. But it must be taking up. Is it taking up a lot of your time, a lot of your headspace? And if so, why is it so important to you?
I to be honest, Claire, like it, I try and I don't try and make it something that I think about on a daily basis. When the reports come out, I read them. I try and get to grips with them. I understand them. I talk to people. I'm a civil engineer. I'm not an aviation engineer. There are so many aspects of all of this I've had to come to grips with over the past 2 years. And I've done that by talking to my lawyers, by talking to technical experts, by reading things myself. You know, so it has taken up, you know, yes, a lot of my time. But it just, for me, the person that Mick was, you know, the person I am, like the, you know, you can't put a price on this. You can't, like, you have to go after the truth. You have to go after justice. And at the same time, you know, I have to deal with the loss of my husband, my best friend, and the father of my two kids, and somehow get our lives together. The only way I can really deal with this is by, you know, kind of going in and out of it. There are times where I need to be quite immersed in it, and then there are times when I just need to switch off. And at those times, I have support from family and friends around me to help, you know, and just be there.
And how would you say you're doing? I mean, you talk about the shock initially of what happened and dealing with the trauma of it 2 years on. I know you've just marked the anniversary, the second anniversary of Mick and his birthday. It would have been his 42nd birthday too. How would you say you and the children in particular are doing?
It's kind of, I mean, it's not something you move on from. It's something you move through. Our lives have been completely turned upside down. All the dreams that we had as a family have, you know, turned into an absolute nightmare. The last 2 years have been incredibly difficult for all of us, you know, but again, I would say that the support of family and friends have, you know, really helped us through. And I just try and keep focused on what Mick would want for us and to somehow keep moving forward. I really do draw my strength from Mick, and, you know, he brought so much joy to our lives, and I try and tap into that joy whenever and wherever I can. You know, but we continue to go through some incredibly painful moments, and and what happened and why it happened is just unreal. It's unimaginable.
He was honoured by the Irish Red Cross recently. Was that important for you and for the wider family?
To have Mick honoured with the Humanitarian the Year Award by the Irish Red Cross last year was incredible. You know, when something as tremendous like this happens, it changes your world. But also you don't want the person to be remembered for just having gotten on a plane that crashed. Mick was an incredible person. He also really admired and respected the Red Cross, and, you know, particularly as frontline workers. And I know he would have been very humbled by the award, and we're just incredibly proud of him for all that he achieved for humanity and the person he was. Like, he was a humanitarian every sense of the word.
Well, Nisha, thank you very much for talking to us, and we wish you well with that ongoing action. Nisha Colony Ryan.
Thanks, Claire.
We put the points raised by Nisha to Boeing, and they've sent us a statement this morning. They say, "We offer our sincere condolences to the loved ones of the passengers and crew aboard Lion Air Flight 610 and Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302. And the memory of those lost drives us every day to ensure the highest levels of safety and quality in everything we do. Boeing has implemented changes that ensure accidents like these will never happen again. And these changes have been validated by the regulatory agencies. We continue to work with global regulators on the safe return to service of the 7378 and 7379.
Nisha Connolly Ryan speaking about her late husband Mick and her civil case against Boeing in the US, as heard on Today with Claire Byrne. The 93rd Annual Academy Award ceremony is this weekend, and with current restrictions, it'll be an Oscars like none before. But also hoping for an unusual Oscars is the team at Kilkenny-based Cartoon Saloon, looking to finally claim a gong after four previous nominations. So, will it be fifth time's the charm for the magnificent Wolfwalkers? The News at One gave us a taste.
She's one of them Wolfwalkers.
Wolfwalkers?
The ones that can talk to wolves with some wild magic.
You can come out now. We can smell ya, you stink. You're a wolf walker. You're a wolf when you sleep. What? A girl when you're awake. Robin, something's happened to me.
Yeah, I can see that. It's flipping great.
You're a wolf now. Be a wolf.
Well, now we can talk to Wolfwalkers screenwriter Will Collins. A very good afternoon to you, Will, and thanks for taking the time out to talk to us. We were just saying in the office earlier, listening to the even the sound there just evokes for us the wonderful experience of sitting in the darkened cinema waiting for the screen to animate in front of us. We're all so much looking forward to getting back to that. But congratulations on yet another Oscar nomination for Cartoon Saloon. And it's, we're told, between yourselves and Soul, perhaps. Is that the way you see it?
Well, I suppose, Brian, well, thanks for having me. Well, according to the bookies, we're the second favourite. And I think, you know, if you were to look at, we had the Annie's Awards last Friday, which are basically like the Oscars for animation, and they're held in Los Angeles. We had 10 nominations and we got 5 wins out of that, which is fairly indicative of the acclaim that the film has been getting and appreciation that all the team have gotten from the animation industry, you know, worldwide, from the big guns over in the US. So but unfortunately, I think personally, I think Soul is going to win it because, you know, the demographic of the Oscar voter, there's about 80,000 Oscar voters, and the likelihood of them actually have seen Wolfwalkers, you know, versus Soul is probably not in our favour, I don't think.
Well, I think the point has been made by some commentators that, you know, every year that Pixar have an animated feature and they're nominated, they win. And nobody really has broken through that yet.
Anytime. There's only twice in the last 18 years that they haven't. And that's because they didn't have a film in the race. It's a very difficult one to win, because in actual fact, you're not just competing against Pixar, you're competing against the entire organization of Disney, which is a multi-billion dollar organization. And Cartoon Saloon is a much smaller company based in Kilkenny. But the pride that we're taking from it is that when I started my journey with Cartoon Saloon, you know, 13, 14 years ago, we were looking up to Pixar and the movies coming out of Pixar and aspiring to one day match their quality. And now we kind of feel that we've made a film that kind of stands, you know, shoulder to shoulder with them. So we're incredibly proud of that feat.
I'm told that the draft for Wolfwalkers went through, is it nine different versions?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I started in 2013, and the process of making animated film is very iterative and collaborative. So, again, we wanted to really do the very best we could. We probably could have stopped at 5 and made that film at 5. But thankfully, we had the budget, thanks to Apple, to be able to push on and kind of go the extra mile with the story and the script. So I was working on it for, you know, the best part of 5 years, really.
Yeah.
But I think pays off really at the end.
And it's very much rooted in Irish mythology, Irish history, and in fact, in what was happening around this time, you know, right there in Kilkenny. It's very, very local in its focus.
Absolutely. It's set in 1650 and a kind of a boiling point in Irish history when the Cromwellian invasion was happening here. And, you know, it was all kind of happening in Kilkenny at that particular point. So the what I love about it is that we're illustrating a part of Irish history that probably hasn't been seen in cinema before. And not only that, but we're telling a family-friendly film and maybe engaging ourselves with not so much an overlooked, but, you know, basically reinvigorating that part of our history and keeping it alive for the next generation to come.
Will Collins from Cartoon Saloon chatting to Brian Dobson. On the Ryan Dougherty Show this morning, we heard from Pride of Pontypridd, the chocolate tone chanteur, the living legend that is Tom Jones. And at 80, what's his secret to keeping his voice so dreamy?
Well, I'm just lucky, really. I mean, I've been blessed with a strong, flexible voice. And it stayed with me. It's amazing because I'm 80 years old now, and a lot of people, a lot of singers that get on in years, their voice gets old. Sometimes the voice is older than the person. But with me, even though I'm old, my voice is still young. It's still working. So, but I drink a lot of water, and I make sure sleep is very important, not to get dehydrated. I always watch for that. You know, I've never smoked cigarettes, so I've been lucky with that. Yeah, not too much alcohol, not like the old days. I think I take better care of myself now than I used to. If I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself.
Yeah, indeed. And your album is called Surrounded by Time, and you talk about the good old days. So how are you feeling these days? You feeling reflective?
Yeah, well, always. You know, I've got a great memory, thank God. And everywhere I've been throughout the world, I've had a lot of fun, especially in Ireland, of course. I always say, which is a fact, Ireland is very similar to Wales. The only difference is the accent, really. But the people are the same. You know, this, I'm sure it's a Celtic thing. It's like that. Scotland as well, you know, I feel like that. But Ireland, I've had some great times. I first came to Ireland in 1965. I played the Boom Boom Room on St. Patrick's Night in Belfast. And that was something.
And of course, the Irish and the Welsh would have pretty good voices on a given night out, or indeed a night in, depending on who you're with. There's some tremendous Irish voices down through the years, Tom. I don't know if you've sung with any of them.
Yeah, well, Bono, you know, and Van Morrison, of course. I've worked with Van on numerous occasions. I met Van, I think, in 64. You know, we go back a long way. I remember we were in London in 65, and you know, Van was, of course, from Belfast, and I'm from Cardiff or thereabouts. So the English bands in those days, you know, they were very English. So they used to talk to one another. So it was just me and Van ended up, you know. Van, I've always said through the years, you know, the only one that would speak to me was Tom Jones. And I said, well, yeah, because we got a lot in common. We come from basically the same kind of background and not being English, you know. So we were not in the click with a lot of the English bands in London at that time.
And as you're reflecting, Thomas, I sense this deep love of where you're from. You have, as you've said, this photographic memory of the past with so many great stories about your hometown and about Wales. So is that where you are now? You're more nostalgic, more wistful?
Well, you know, Wales to me is more of a memory than anything else now, because in Pontypridd, a lot of the buildings have been pulled down now. I mean, there was a big cinema that, excuse me, that my wife's family owned. It was called the County Cinema, and they were Trenchards. And that's being pulled down now. I think they're making it into flats. And that was the big cinema in Pontypridd, the County Cinema, when I was growing up there. But now it's even that's being pulled down or changed. And the pubs, of course, like everywhere else, they're closing daily. So a lot of the pubs that I used to frequent when I was in Wales, a lot of them are not there anymore.
And do you ever think about maybe what might have been? And, you know, you talk about the coal mines, because so many of the men your age would have been expected to follow their dads down the mines.
Yeah, well, I would have done, only I had tuberculosis, excuse me, when I was 12 till I was 14. I was quarantined in the house that we had there. And so the doctor said, look, whatever you do, you can't go down the mine. Well, ordinarily, when I left school at 15, I would have gone with my father because he was a coal miner all his life. So I would have been, I would have been down there. So getting TB really saved me from going into the coal mine. So that was a good thing that came out of it. And of course, it taught me a lesson, because when you're quarantined for 2 years, when you're 12 years old, you know, it's tough. So I understand what's going on today, or I think I do, more than somebody that's never experienced it before. Not being able to go out and play with the kids, you know, like that. It's a terrible thing for a child, I think.
Yeah, of course. And you had that experience of lockdown as a child in some ways. So now, as a man of a certain vintage, if I may, you perhaps have a greater empathy with what young people are going through at the moment.
Quite right, quite right.
Can I ask you about it? Because I've heard you tell the story before, and I know you arch your eyebrows somewhat when you do. But tell me about the time you met Elvis.
Well, at the time, because the Beatles had really knocked Elvis out of joint. And so he saw me as a sort of a a shining light, because all the British invasion, you know, in America was all groups apart from myself. So when I met Elvis, you know, he said, thank God for you, because I thought the whole thing was going to be taken over by British bands. And but he said, you know, you have a very similar voice to his. And he wanted to know why did I sing like the way I sing? And I said, well, because you were partly to blame, you know, listening to 50s rock and roll songs. That's what I was really listening to. But then he was talking about black gospel churches where he was brought up. And I said, no, they were not black gospel churches in Pontypridd. You had to go to Cardiff, you know, for that. But it was just listening to the radio, keeping your ears open. And I think being in Wales, like Ireland, is very musical. And so we pick up a lot of stuff, you see. I remember the Chieftains. I did a show with the Chieftains, and Paddy was saying the Heartbreak Hotel comes from an Irish song. So it's tremendous, you know, when you think about it. Da 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 da. You know, it was like that. So yeah. So I mean, the roots are there. You see, it's Celtic roots, I think, basically.
Yeah, it's funny you should say, because we had Paddy on the show a few weeks ago for St. Patrick's Day, and I probably should have asked him to take out the tin whistle and play Heartbreak Hotel.
Yeah.
And did Elvis, is this true or not, did Elvis follow you into your dressing room at one point, Tom? So keen was he for you to hear a song that he had in his head.
Yes. Yeah, I was in the shower. I came off the stage and he was there in the wings, and I ran past him and he said, Tom, I got this song, man. You know, you got to listen to this song. I said, yeah, okay, but I got to jump in the shower at the moment because I was perspiring. And so I'm in the shower and I'm washing my hair and I hear Elvis Presley. And I thought, wait a minute, I must be going nuts here, because it was a big shower. So I and he was like, you know, like giving the Elvis thing. And in a bar, in a shower, you know, that thing was like, he was creating his own echo chamber. So it was like, I looked, the shower head was close to the door, and I opened my eyes, got the shampoo out of my hair, and there was Elvis's face. He was leaning over the door, singing this bloody song to me. So it was, and they, people have said to me, so what was the song? I said, I don't know, I couldn't understand it.
And tell me, is it true that the Beatles had the song The Long and Winding Road earmarked for you before they did it themselves?
Yes. Well, Paul McCartney. I was with Paul in a club in London called the Scots of St. James's, It's just off of German Street. And we were chatting one night, and I said, do you think you could write me a song, Paul? And he said, sure. So he did. And then he sent it around to my house in England, in just outside of London. And it was The Long and Winding Road. So my recording manager at the time, Peter Sullivan, he said, you know, you've got a record coming out, which was called Without Love. It was coming out on the Friday, and this was like on the Monday. And I said, well, I'd love to do this Long and Winding Road. And he said, well, we'll have to, you know, Decca Records, we'll have to put the stop on Without Love, and they're all geared up for it. And it would take us at least a month to get this thing, you know, with an arrangement and get the studio time. But if you want to do it, then, you know, it was all on me. And I said, well, let's have some help here. But nobody was willing to give it to me. And Paul said that it would have to be my next single if I was going to do it. So to try and tell Decca Records at that time that I wanted to put a hold on this record that was coming out on Friday and record a Paul McCartney song, that was like, that wasn't happening. So it was a shame that I missed it because the timing was off. And he said, if you don't want it as your next single, then I'll do it myself. So I missed it. But I should have stuck to my guns and said, look, we've got to stop this and we've got to record this song, you know, and stop the one coming out on Friday. And then we could have done it. So, but we didn't. So I missed it.
I've been lucky enough to see you perform a few times, Tom Jones, once on The Late Late Show, once in Brighton a couple of years ago, once in the Marquee, wonderful gig in Cork. And it was magnificent. And I'm sorry to say, it was shortly after your wife had passed away, and I should offer my condolences to you for that.
Thank you.
I hope you don't mind me asking you to share your thoughts on this, but you sang a song for her that night. I remember watching you sing the song, and I really felt that we lost you on the stage to that song.
Yeah, it was called Tomorrow Night. It was an album that I'd done with Ethan Johns, and I played it to Linda. That was the last album that she heard me do, and she picked up on that a song called Tomorrow Night. So when I was doing it on stage, you know, I was thinking about her, but she told me that. She said, you know, if you think about me when you're on stage, think of me laughing. Don't think of me now, you know, because she wasn't well there towards the end. So that was it, and I did, and it gives me strength when I get on stage now. I can see her laughing, you know, when I sing. I hope she's not like laughing at me, but she's she's laughing with me. So yeah, so it's nice. But that, I remember that night very well.
Good, yeah, because I felt it was very generous of you to share that with the crowd that night. How have you been, Tom, since Linda passed away? Are you doing okay?
Yeah, and well, I'm doing better now. It's an old saying, but it's true. Time heals, because when it happened, I didn't think I'd be able to sing. I really didn't. I thought it's going to stick in my throat. I won't be able to get the words out, because if you get too emotional when you sing, you see, it doesn't work. You've got to try and channel it and have good thoughts, and that'll sort of see you through. So at the beginning was hard. But the audience, you see, when you get on stage, like that night in Cork, you see, they know that you're under pressure
yes.
And they lift you up. It's a tremendous, tremendous feeling. But the audience does that. You know, you know you're not on your own. You know, in your time of need, you're there and they lift you up.
Well, of course, we're dying to see you back in concert again. I presume you've got vaccines coming out of your ears at this stage, do you?
I have. I've had the two of them done. I had the first one was before Christmas, in December, and the second one was on January the 6th. So I think I'm bulletproof. I hope I am. But now everybody else has got to get the vaccines as well, you see. And then, because Cork is definitely on the, that marquee was booked for last summer, but now hopefully we'll do it this year, with a lot of other shows in Ireland as well. So the sooner I can get back to it, the better I'll feel. And everybody's waiting for entertainment now. Everybody wants to get out and listen and see shows and be part of it. And the entertainers, we entertainers, feel exactly the same way. We want to get out there and... Because you can't do anything without an audience. You know, you can't. You can be... You can have the vaccine, you can do everything that's possible, but without that audience, then, you know, what are you doing?
It's so good to hear you talking away there today and in such good form. And I'm laughing at that guy all those years ago who said you wouldn't have a future because of all that curly hair.
Well, when I went to London, you see, from Cardiff, they said curly hair doesn't work anymore. I said, what? And they said, you know, because the Beatles and the Stones, they were so big that everybody was trying to look like that. They wanted that Beatles hairstyle, and which was straight. Well, my hair was curly, so they tried to straighten it out at one point, but it didn't look. I looked like a fool. So, and then they said that macho stuff went out with Elvis Presley, and I said, well, Elvis Presley hasn't gone out in my mind. All those 50s rockers, you know, are still alive and well and living in me. So, and what worked in Cardiff is only 160 miles from London. And I said, Christ, if I was cutting it in Cardiff, why can't I do it in London? It's not that different, surely. And of course, you know, I got It's Not Unusual, and then I was off and running. But before that, I was up against it because the rock scene was so big, you know, the bands were so big. Anyway, thank God I cut through.
I love that you were on shows like the Ed Sullivan Show, and they have, don't they, like a certain style of, at the time at least, conservatism, and they wanted you to change the lyrics to the song Delilah, but not the lyric about murder.
No, exactly. So when they said we have to change a line in Delilah, I said, well, you know, I felt the knife in my hand and she laughed no more. If we don't have that in there, what else is left? They said, oh, no, it's not that. It's not about him killing the girl. I said, well, what is it then? They said, well, look, at break of day, when the man drove away, I was waiting. I said, right? And they said, well, you can't do that on Sunday night television, because that means that he was with her all night. And I said, well, why do you think he kills her? Why do you think I felt the knife? You know, I mean, he kills her because she's unfaithful to him. But that didn't bother them. It was just that it was saying that this man had been with this girl all night. So I had to go, at break of day, I was still across the way. I was waiting. Okay.
Well, last question, Tom. Today, you're in such great spirits, and it's been great having you on the programme this morning. Your memory is extraordinary. How are you feeling about life, broadly speaking, legacy, the future?
Well, this album that I've got now, Surrounded by Time, hopefully it won't be my last, but if it was, then it's not a bad way, you know, to sort of stop recording. I don't want to stop, and I'm not going to, but this album, I think, represents me now better than I've done for a long time. And I think people are going to really enjoy it. I hope they do anyway, because I really enjoyed making it, and we explored with new sounds. You know, I said to Ethan John and my son Mark, they both produced it together, and I said, look, as long as I sound like me, then, you know, don't mess with my vocals. But the instrumentation is tremendous, and it paid off.
Tom Jones on The Ryan Tubridy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily this week. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.